This is Rewired Radio with Erica Spiegelman, addiction and wellness specialist, motivational speaker, and author, helping individuals, couples, and families regain a sense of control, leading to personal growth, wellness, and a more fulfilling life. Here's Erica Spiegelman.
Welcome, everyone. So happy that you're with me today. When you imagine an alcoholic, what do you see? Many of us probably wouldn't guess that a successful, busy, suburban mom may also be struggling with addiction. My guest today, Martha Carucci, knows that with her experience that her appearance can be deceiving, or anyone's appearance can be deceiving for that matter. Martha's here today to share her firsthand experience about coming to grips with her addiction and learning how to balance her sobriety with her job, marriage, and kids. She'll also talk about her book, Sobrieties, which is a unique look at the power of owning our own story. I'm so happy to have her with us today. Martha Carucci, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Erica. Very happy to be on with you.
So when I was saying, can you imagine an alcoholic? You know, so many of us deal with this stigma every single day of what an alcoholic looks like or what somebody addicted to something may appear to be. But really, it affects every age, every race, every demographic you could think of out there. And it's, an insidious ailment that I think can affect anybody. And we just have to raise more awareness around this, would you say?
I believe that 100% exactly what you said, that it's alcoholism is a disease that doesn't discriminate against age or race or socioeconomic background. And I think there is still such a stigma around the disease that my, goal is to really raise awareness of it and get the discussion going so that people know that when they think of the word alcoholic, it's not just the bum on the street with the brown paper bag, but it's a mom like me living in the suburbs that could be sitting next to you at the PTA meeting who may be suffering from a disease that that you just have sort of a preconceived notion of that people do, and they don't really understand that it can affect everyone, as you said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could affect everybody. And the more that we talk about it, I find, I've been on the front lines doing counseling with people for, 9 years now and sober myself for 10 years. And I just know that if we're not aware to look at the signs, and be really, I think, emotionally, open-hearted and open-minded to the people around you that you see are suffering or isolating, and knowing what those red flags are, then we can start to help people. But I think the more that we are ignorant to what those signs are, the less that we can help.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a huge fan of your work, and congratulations on 10 years of sobriety. You're inspiration for us. I'm coming up on 5 years on Sunday, and I'm really excited about that milestone. So,
that's a huge one.
Yeah,
huge.
Thank you. It requires a great deal of sensitivity to those around us, as you said. It's just being able to look for the signs and letting people know that they're not alone, I think, is such a key point in this whole process. And so part of the reason that I'm so outspoken about my recovery and, with the book, is to let people know that they aren't alone and that there's help available, and that wherever they are in their process and whatever their cross to bear is, it's never too late to try to turn things around. I'm 47 and I got sober, as I said, 5 years ago. I know people in recovery who are a lot older and started the process later in life, but are enjoying every minute of their sobriety and so grateful that they're where they are and have turned things around from when they were drinking and just suffering in silence.
Yeah. And that's why I tip my hat off to you for having the courage to not only write your book, but to also be so open with it. And I want to get into a little bit, if you don't mind sharing your story. But for a minute, this quote just popped in my head and I just went to find it. But it says, for most people, recovery means not having to keep secrets from yourself, including secrets about the ways that you have managed to survive. And I think that's so powerful, because I feel like I'm lucky enough to be surrounded by people like you and connected to people like you and other people in recovery country that have managed to survive and are transparent and authentic and open about it, because it helps so many people. We don't realize when you are aware of your own story and step into your truth and share it, someone else feels like they're not alone anymore, you know? So it's really just, it's amazing that that's what you're doing too. So I feel honored to be connected today.
Thank you so much.
So yeah, can you share a little bit about your own story and how you have found this healthy path?
Sure. I started drinking pretty young. I was about 14 when my best friend and I thought it would be a great idea to fill our bicycle water bottles with gin and tonic. That was, you know, from my parents' cupboard. And we rode around on our bikes, and I immediately loved the feeling that it gave me for a kid who was sort of suffering from anxiety and just a little bit nervous socially, and you know, all of the pressures of middle school and then high school. It was just an immediate welcomed escape from reality. Mm-hmm. And I drank throughout high school, and then in college it just got progressively worse. And as you know, it's a progressive disease that, you know, by the time I was at the height of my drinking, I was drinking every day. I was hiding bottles. I would start making dinner for my family, you know, around 5 o'clock, and open that bottle of wine. And it was a feeling of, you know, I couldn't wait to get to that point of that first drink and the, you know, the exhale and the let out and the relaxation and that came with that first sip. And before I knew it, I finished the entire bottle of wine and hid it in the recycling bin from my husband. So when he got home from work, he wouldn't know that I'd already had a whole bottle. And we would, you know, he'd suggest, hey, let's open a bottle of wine when he got home. And I'd say, great idea. So we would open it and drink throughout dinner. And once I started, you know, I like to tell people that I have a broken off switch. Once I start, I can't stop. The idea of a little bit of alcohol that made me start feeling so much better and feel the escape was just a case of let's just have more. More is better. More was always better. So it was, it became earlier and earlier in the day that I would reach for the bottle, and most nights ended up with me passing out before my kids were ready to be tucked into bed, so that was left for my husband to do. Mm-hmm. I spent many days just waking up completely hungover and biding my time until I could have a little bit of the hair of the dog and start the whole process again. And it was really a vicious cycle that went on for years, and there were many times when I knew I had a problem and I knew I should have stopped, but I didn't want to. It was such an integral part of my life. I think, you know, I was a lobbyist for many years in the telecommunications industry, and I was surrounded by drinking. It was such a part of the culture on Capitol Hill, and I thought it was normal to just be out at receptions and fundraisers and charity events and dinners and drinking. And that to me was just the normal. But I, you know, there was one occasion where I fell down a set of very steep stairs, concrete stairs, and should have been killed. And I wasn't. I got up and walked away. There were times when people said stuff to me about my drinking, and I just wasn't ready to hear it. And there was a morning when my 10-year-old daughter said to me, hey, Mom, you know, we had this whole conversation last night. Don't you remember? And I was completely ashamed. I just had no recollection of it. But even that wasn't enough to stop me from drinking. And it went on until Memorial Day weekend of 2012, when I was in New York City with a couple girlfriends, one of whom had lost her husband to alcoholism. And my hand was shaking. My hands were shaking at lunchtime until I got a drink in me. And I had just kind of physically come to the point where my body was really crying out for help, saying that, you know, the alcohol was taking its toll on it. And at four in the morning, after hours of trying to get the words out, I managed to say to her, you know what, I have a serious drinking problem. And she said, I know you do. And I just said, why didn't you say something? And she said, because you had to come to this decision on your own. And now that you have, you know, we're going to get you some help. So that's kind of a very abbreviated history of my drinking.
Yeah. And you know what? I relate to all of it. Seriously. It's that insidious cycle. It's that, you know, physical allergy that comes for some of us that, you know, we can't really ignore anymore. But right. That self-betrayal, that voice of self-betrayal, that internal voice every morning waking up, you know, not remembering things, not feeling like you're living your best life. I mean, I think that day in and day out, the shaving off of your integrity every single day, a little bit more, a little bit more, a little bit more, and you're left spiritlessness, you know, the spiritlessness palpable. That's, you know, that's kind of when these moments happen. And it's not necessarily like I talk about it in my book Rewired. It's not necessarily one big defining moment, but all these little moments that add up to this one moment of finally saying, you know, God, I need help, or to someone else, I need help, or even loud enough to yourself.
Yeah, I think the way that you put it summarizes it like absolutely perfectly. Like you said, little by little, it just shaves off a little bit more, and it takes away your spirit. I think I couldn't say it any better myself.
Yeah, well, I relate. So that's kind of where I defined it for myself, was just that feeling of hopelessness and spiritlessness and that constant self-betrayal that is just exhausting. So I'm really so happy for you and so grateful that you are sharing your story now. And so you started then writing and you became a blogger. And tell me a little bit about how you have been lighting the way for others.
Yeah, I started writing about my story I got sober in May of 2012. So in January of 2013, I decided to start a blog. And, you know, initially it was just so cathartic for me to write and to kind of put my thoughts and feelings down on paper. I know that a lot of people in their recovery journal, but I wanted to make it more. I wanted to put it out there to be able to help other people and share my story, as you say, to kind of shed some light on the subject and to show other people there's a light at the end of the tunnel. I kept my blog anonymous for about a year, and a local pastor who I sat next to on my son's field trip, his son and mine were in the same class, and he heard my story and he said, you know, I'd really love to interview you for my congregation and I will play it anonymously. So I talked to my husband, who's a retired Navy officer and who I considered a pretty private guy, and I was just shocked initially when he said, look, if you think that it's important for you to try to help other people with this message, then why don't you just forget the anonymity piece? Mm-hmm. And I was really surprised, and from then I wrote a piece called Coming Out Party, and it was me saying, look, you know, almost everybody knows somebody who is in some way affected by addiction, and if you don't, well, then you do right now. And I've been writing this blog anonymously as Sober Mom for a year, and it's me, and I am just your neighbor, your friend, your kid's friend's mom, and someone you see at the soccer games, and I'm an alcoholic. And it was met with such an amazing amount of support, and I was overwhelmed with the people who reached out to me and just said, good for you, and we're here for you, and we think what you're doing is great. And, you know, I joke in the book about the fact that there wasn't a lot of surprise from my friends. There wasn't anybody who was like, oh my God, you're an alcoholic? No way. Right, there was a lot of, you thank God you're getting help. You know, they knew, they saw it. They and as you know, as in, when we're in the throes of our disease, we are a little bit oblivious to the fact that life is going on around us and people can see. They can see what we can't see so easily. And they, for the most part, were not surprised with my revelation, but they were happy that I was in a place where I was getting some help and turning things around.
Yeah, oh, that's fantastic. So I'm going to just ask you, because I feel like I discuss this a lot with clients day to day. You know, when you changed your life, you know, you mentioned your husband drank with you. Like, how was that? How did that shape your relationship now? Or was he supportive? Did he was he not drinking as much? Or did he stop drinking when you stopped? And how did your friends treat you? I just wanted to know, it sounds like you were met with a lot of support and love, which is fantastic. But for people that are wondering how you dealt with that, those kinds of things, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. And those things were really, really hard because life as I knew it completely changed. And I knew that morning in New York City when I made that declaration and admitted that I was an alcoholic, that life had to change. You know, it can't just, you can't just stop drinking. That's just not going
to. Right. Everything has to change. Right.
Exactly. And everything changing is very hard, as you know. It's my husband was very supportive. He really stopped drinking around me. He doesn't drink that much, but it was something we did together socially, and we really enjoyed our wine together. He enjoys good scotch, and he was very sensitive to the fact that I wasn't drinking, I couldn't drink. So he just stopped for a long time drinking, and when he did find himself in a social situation where he was offered a drink, you know, he would look at me and say, "Are you okay with me having a drink?" And he still does. He still checks with me, which I think is very considerate and sensitive. Yeah. And he's cut way back on his drinking as well. But it is something that was initially hard because it was what we enjoyed doing together. Friends is another huge challenge, and it's still something 5 years later that, you know, I went out on Wednesday, this past Wednesday night, with a bunch of girlfriends for a friend's birthday, and it's still hard for me. In the beginning, I couldn't do it at all. I had to remove myself from people, places, and things that were triggers, and my group of friends is somebody that I partied with a lot. You know, there were other moms that I was always opening my door to happy hours and to, you know, just any occasion, tailgates at the kids' games and trick-or-treat, you know, before Halloween parties and before PTA meetings, you have drinks and you name it. And there was a reason to drink. So it was hard for me to pull myself away from that group, but I had to. I really had to change everything in my life. And for the most part, there was support. Some of it was some of them just found it hard to be around me and not drink and didn't really understand my situation. So definitely a lot of friendships for me changed. And, you know, on the other side of that, there are people who I knew maybe just as acquaintances or not so well, who really stepped up and just were there for me with unconditional support. And on a Friday night would call me at 5 o'clock and say, "Hey, how are you doing?" And I'd say, "I'm terrible. It's 5 o'clock and I really wish I could have a drink." And they'd say, "Come on, let's go for a walk. You know, let's take my dog out for a walk. Let's do, let's do something that, you know, gets your mind off it." So the friendships, have really been an interesting thing. And I write about it in the book. I write a couple pieces about relationships and friendships and how they change with sobriety.
Yeah, yeah. So let's talk about sobrieties for a moment. And I love the title. How did you come up with that?
Thank you. You know, I just, I was thinking about it and I was realizing that I could approach this journey with laughter or with tears. And there were so many tears involved during the drinking and during the initial recovery. And I decided I was going to approach this with a bit of humor. And it just, the title Sobrieties just came to me, and it's, you know, it's the, it's about the journey. It's filled with laughter, but it's also filled with, it's very heartfelt. So it tells the true story, but it also incorporates as humor wherever I can do that.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's so, it's so wonderful that you're sharing that too. You know, we have to look at things kind of with a sense of humor and a sense of purpose, you know, like it's, and it's also when you were saying, you know, like it was 5 o'clock, you can't, at some point you had to must say to yourself, "I'm choosing not to." It is your choice. And, you know, it's your choice to look at it with laughter, and it's your choice to look at it in a way of loss. If you're feeling lost that day, you know, I mean, it's a relationship, which is usually, a primary one before we stop drinking. I mean, it's the relationship. So with that being said, of course, there's going to be a sense of loss and grief and anger and sadness and all the stages. But at the same time, I think seeing it as a way to learn your biggest lesson, to help others, to see how it's meant to be in the bigger scheme of your life is such a beautiful thing. And then to add a little bit of humor to it is, you know, I mean, you have to laugh at some of the things that you've done. You know, even to this day, my mom is, I did something not really nice to her, but it was kind of funny. At the now it's funny, but at the time, I think she was a little upset by it. But I mean, you know, now it's funny just to see the lengths of how you become hijacked by this stuff, you know, right. and the ridiculousness that ensues, you know, that's what I mean. Yeah,
absolutely. And it's so funny that you, you know, use the word choice the way you did, because that night in New York City, the last night I was drinking, I argued with my best friend, the one whose husband passed away from alcoholism, about whether or not there's a choice. And knowing that I was suffering from the disease but not willing to admit it yet, I kept arguing, you know, no, there isn't a choice. The disease is making the choice for you. And she just held her ground and said, you know what, we're going to disagree on this, because there's a choice how you handle it. And I've come around full circle to believe what she said and agree with her that it's a choice how you handle it. And just like you said, it's a choice how you're going to live your life, and it's a choice if I'm going to approach this with laughter or with tears. So choice is a key word to me, and mm-hmm. you really hit it on the nail on the head with that. And there's a couple pieces in the book about choice. So as far as the humor, it is, you're right, there are things that I look back on and at the time maybe weren't so funny, but right now, right. you know, you have to find the humor in them, because what's the alternative? It's what's done is done, but, and I don't mean to make light of any of the, you know, very serious situations, but where you can find the humor, I think it's important to do so to, you know, you have to move forward. So I talk in the book about when I first got sober, there were the friends that I mentioned who were maybe on the sidelines who stepped up. And, you know, one of them said to me, let's go do this Bible study together. And I was like, I have absolutely no idea about the Bible. And she said, just come. It's something, you know, that doesn't involve drinking. And so I went with her and I said to her, I was like, you know, I don't know what we're in for, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't involve taking shots every time someone says the name Jesus. And she laughed, and you know, I was like, it's an activity that I'm going to go into and come out as sober as I was when I went in. So that's a healthy thing. But, awesome. You know, there were situations like that, and I started working out with her and some other friends and just finding activities that didn't focus around drinking. And I learned to just find humor in life where I could. And I wanted the book to be not just for alcoholics, but for people who are on both sides of the disease, people who love them and want to help. And it says, you know, on the back of the book, whatever your struggle, whatever your cross to bear, it's never too late to turn things around. And I want people to see that there is hope, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. And if I can turn things around, you know, they can too. So I quote Brené Brown on the back of the book, and it says, her quote is, loving ourselves through the process of owning our story is the bravest thing we'll ever do. If we own the story, then we can write the ending. And, you know, I say that working on owning my story is one of the best things I've ever done for myself. I get to write the ending. I get to make those choices of how I'm going to go forward.
I love that. I love that quote. And it's so powerful, too, to again, it's like back to that word choice. It's in owning your own story. It's all of that is really empowering, and people don't understand, I think, when they're in these kind of dark places, whether it's addiction or anxiety or a divorce or whatever's going on in their lives, that at any point they have the tools. If they also, if they reach out, obviously they'll gain more tools, but they have what it takes to kind of own your own story and see that, you know, we all have choices, and that's empowering. I could get off this, you know, I could step away from the show after, and I choose to, you know, do the next best thing, or I could choose to do something which will be very detrimental, but it's my choice in the end. And so, and I understand too, that when you are hijacked by an addiction or drug, I consider alcohol a drug too. When you're hijacked by something like that in your shaking to, you know, shaking to the bone, because, you know, the alcohol is leaving your system, and you feel like you have no choice but to drink, that's a different story. And I'm not saying, you know, I mean, that's a whole nother, you know, that's a whole nother beast. But when you are sober and you are working on yourself and you are consciously choosing a healthy path, just seeing it as a choice, I feel like helps people feel more empowered. That, you know, when I hear clients say, I can't go, you know, I can't drink, or I can't do this. And it's like, Or, you know, like, I'm told not to. I'm like, that's not going to work. I mean, we're all going to rebel against that eventually. You have to be the one that chooses, I think.
So. Right, and I agree 100% with what you said about the choice, you know, and especially with relation to the disease and when you're under the being hijacked by the disease. I agree. I read something somewhere, and I don't remember where it was, about looking at things differently. And again, it's a choice as to how you decide to look at things. And it said to approach things as, instead of saying, I have to go pick up my kids at school, I have to make dinner tonight, to look at it and say, I get to pick up my kids at school, I get to make dinner, and think about the blessings that come with, you know, what you have that you might not appreciate. Like the fact that I am able to go pick up my kids at school because I'm not drunk, I'm not hungover, I'm not facing getting in the car and getting a DUI. I'm present for my kids, you know. Yes, and I get to make dinner because I'm blessed with food and a table and things that a lot of people who suffer from this disease, you know, might be living on the streets, maybe trying to figure out where they're getting their next meal. I know people in the rooms who are, you know, have lived out of garbage cans. And so that was something that was just wonderful for me to hear, to remember saying what I get to do versus what I have to do, and look at things mm-hmm. in a much different way, a much mm-hmm, more appreciative yeah. way, and with a lot of gratitude.
Exactly. Yeah, it's that gratitude. It's that gratitude that, you know, changes everything. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting. I know it sounds so woo-woo, but it is something where, you know, it's true. And I love that. I love that you see that too. Martha, thank you so much for being with me today. It's such a wonderful, insightful book and a conversation that, you know, I know we could have for a very long time. So I'd love to have you back on. But in the meantime, please tell everybody where they can find you, and they can find Sobriety is your book.
Sobrieties is on Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. My blog is WordPress. I'm sorry, sobrieties.wordpress.com.
Okay, awesome. That's so great. And people could find you there and connect with you as well, huh?
Absolutely.
Okay, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your courage and for your strength and for lighting the way for everybody. You're listening to Rewired Radio on Radio MD. I'm Erica Spiegelman. Thank you all for joining us today, and stay well.